Hey, optimists. If there's one thing that unites us in the global village of today, it's the richness and beauty of our differences. As the philosopher Voltaire apocryphally once remarked, I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And this remains an underpinning intellectual tenet today of evolved democratic societies. It's in that context that we enjoy the freedom to present and debate ideas and ideologies, and to contend for the right to shape the world for our children. It's important to remember that such freedoms are not yet afforded equally across all nations, and that much blood continues to be shed in their pursuit inside regions of conflict in our world. In this episode, I speak with Corey Feldman, who has completed military service in one such region, and who saw how even in the West, the words of leaders can still lead to violent acts between polarized parties. We discuss his recently published memoir, the wisdom he gained from travel, and how his experiences motivated him to put his skills to work in healthcare for the holistic treatment of patients. So let's get started. And please do take a moment to like and subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast app. Toda, shukran. Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Chief Executive Optimist podcast, exploring conscious capitalism and inclusive leadership and helping you high performers to preserve your sanity and humanity in this time of relentless change. Today I'm joined from New York by digital healthcare growth leader, strategist, MBA coach and published author, Corey Feldman. Welcome, Corey. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Corey and I met as fellow students in our MBA cohort just over 3 years ago now, and met up in Dublin and London and have remained friends since. But a lot of water has passed under the bridge in the intervening period for both of us in our respective lives, and indeed much has changed globally in that time. So Corey, perhaps you could start by giving us a brief tour of your life up to this point to put listeners in the picture on your journey so far.
Sure. I will try to make it brief. After graduating from university, I moved to Israel, where I served for 3 years in the Israeli Defense Forces. I'm Jewish and was raised with a love of Israel. So for me, this was kind of a natural next step in putting my money where my mouth was, so to speak. I believe in Israel's right to exist and to defend itself. And so for me, it was a no-brainer that I was going to go there and do that myself. Thereafter, I was a bit confused about what I wanted to do, but I knew that I liked Israelis. So I worked for an Israeli company and ended up working for a company called Taboola, which does sponsored content advertising. And through that company, I actually learned Portuguese, moved down to Brazil, and was able to open up the company's publisher sales operations in South America. So I was in Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, and thereafter I made the jump into digital healthcare, running sales for my friend's company, Parachute Health. And that was kind of my first look into the world of healthcare and digital healthcare, which is a world that I have remained in ever since and intend to remain in for the rest of my career. I hope that's brief enough.
Super. Yeah, very succinct. Probably not the first time you've done that.
It's the beauty of interviewing.
Exactly. No, thank you. Very comprehensive. So we tend to start our episodes with a bit of an icebreaker. That icebreaker really is asking our guests to focus on something of interest, which has been occupying their mind in recent weeks, like an idea, an article, a concern, an issue, a book, a film. So something that, you know, has really been chundering on in the back of your gray matter for a bit. You've got a busy and inquisitive mind. I'm sure it's whirring away on something. So, Corey, what's been occupying your thoughts of late?
Well, Scotch is wearing it away, but it's wearing away on the following. I interviewed a gentleman named Nate Link on my podcast, who's the chief medical officer of one of the largest public hospitals in America. And he wrote a book called An Ailing Nation. And he compares evidence-based medicine to politics, right? So in medicine, he calls out the mortality meetings of old, where if you screwed up, someone would say, why didn't you just shoot the patient in the head if you wanted to kill them? And unsurprisingly, to a man enlightened like yourself, this does not induce the desire within anyone to want to come forward and admit mistakes. And he laments the fact that our political system is very much like those meetings of old. I think about, you and I both have basically very few good things to say about the Trump administration. And, you know, if given the choice, I would vote for Biden again every time over Trump. But I have been very disappointed in his behavior in Afghanistan. You know, at the end, it was clear that things were not going right. And instead of saying, hey, the buck stops with me, things are not going right, and here's what I'm doing to fix them, he pretended everything was okay right through the end. And to me, that was a huge miss. I think about the episode in Cuba where JFK botched the Bay of Pigs invasion and came on and said, the responsibility for this lies on me and me alone. This is my fault. And then I think about the fact that I don't think that's happened since in American politics. Leaders are simply not accountable. They are afraid to come forward and say, I made a mistake. And the question of whether that's the fault of the leaders or the fault of a culture that attacks people who make mistakes is an open one. But it is a frustration to me that the things that we look for in leaders within companies that we want to join are notably absent in the world of politics.
Yeah, I think that speaks very strongly to this whole inclusive leadership theme that runs through the Chief Executive Optimist, and how humility and authenticity and vulnerability are traits that leaders in business these days need to exhibit in order to garner the hearts and minds and love of their workforce. I think if we continue to operate under a veneer of blamelessness, people see through it these days. And I don't think that's necessarily extended to many serving politicians currently. That humility almost doesn't seem to have permission, even though some of them may be human underlying everything and not narcissists that the media might make them out to be. There is not room to be apologetic without showing weakness in that space. And I think in the spirit of leadership, that needs to become permissible first, and maybe the media have a great role to play in that, in encouraging it and without vilifying it. What are your thoughts there?
I totally agree with you. The problem is, as with anything, an object in motion stays in motion unless acted upon, right? And so the question is, what gives? Typically, it takes an explosion for people to look around and say, oh, shit, things look pretty bad right now, and to make a drastic change. And the exception to that is when private companies or individuals come together and create something that's so compelling that it forces a slight deviation on the track that ultimately leads to the place where those people had hoped it would go, right? And so, I just wonder, we've come so far down this road of bashing each other across the aisle, of divisive politics. How do we get back to that place? I think there has to be an equivalent, and we'll tie this back into healthcare, of what America did when it realized that tooth decay was becoming a problem. Instead of saying you need to brush your teeth more, Michigan became the first city to put fluoride in the water to fix that problem. So they didn't ask the local folks to change their behavior. They said, keep doing exactly what you've been doing and things will get better. And I see that all the time in digital healthcare, right? If you're asking people to make behavior change, even if it's going to benefit them in the medium to long term, it's really hard for them to see past the short term. If you've ever sat with a case manager in a U.S. hospital, her phone rings literally nonstop. And so even if putting an order on a fax machine is incredibly inefficient, for her to have to change, or he to have to change the way he or she is thinking about that process requires time that is simply not available in the current workflow. And so the path of least resistance is how I find that innovation typically travels when it travels successfully. And I don't yet have a good answer for how we apply that to the world of politics and create a culture of accountability where it's okay to come out and say, I made this mistake. But I've seen how it's been unsuccessful, the present system in politics. I've seen how it looks different in the private sector when we think about accountability and when we think about innovation. And I do wonder if there's some way to marry those two and take what we've learned from the latter and apply it to the former.
I'd like to believe there is some innovation, some pathway open to developed nations to effectively give a greater bit of license to governments and to leaders specifically to innovate in office, innovate in public, as tends to be the trend now in the business world. Let's turn, in the time we have, to your recently published first book, A Line in the Sand, An American Story of Service and Sacrifice in the Israeli Special Forces, which is somewhat autobiographical in nature, focusing on your 3 years spent in the IDF up to 2013 and how it shaped your early 20s and perhaps some of your worldview. In it, you speak of your love for the beauty and promise of Israel, and the military training that you received, some of the missions and duties you undertook, the friends you made, some friends, unfortunately, who lost, your progression into the special forces training, your injury, your ultimate disappointment that you were unable to continue with that advanced training, and how you reflected and converted an initial sense of failure into a powerful and galvanizing motivation for your life to come as you continued as a regular soldier and ultimately now as a reservist, I think. So tell us, if you will, Corey, now 8 years on from that defining moment in your life, what memories are forefront and would ultimately summarize the sort of theme of your book, if you will?
Sure. I think the two things that stick with me are kind of one personal and one global. The personal takeaway is that sense of resilience that I think the IDF helped me build, right? When you're doing things that you previously deemed impossible. So if you know, 15 years ago, you told me I was going to walk with 30% of my body weight on a torn meniscus for 100 miles over 4 days, I tell you, you were crazy. But then the Army says, you're going to do this, or you'll be doing the navigation course again. And you say, oh shit, I guess I'm doing this. You are doing something that your body says there's absolutely no way you can do. And your mind says, I'm going to find a way through this. And lo and behold, you do. And it kind of sheds light on, for the rest of your life, what are these other preconceived limitations that I'm holding that are just not true? This may be a bit of a stretch, but when I think about the role that psychedelics can play in healing trauma, PTSD, anxiety, depression, what I think is so special about them is that they take you outside of your initial narrative and show you in first person, in the case of a hallucination, a world that's bigger than yourself. And being in that first person sense is what allows someone to say, okay, this thing that's bothering me is but a small microcosm of the larger world that I play in. And I think it's 1/3 of mushroom users reported as the most significant spiritual experience of their life. And so just pulling that back to the military experience, I think having that first person experience, truly believing that there was something that I couldn't do and then doing it will forever stay with me as I think about other things, right? And so for me, you know, learning Portuguese and selling in a foreign language that I didn't speak 5 months earlier at the surface seemed a tall order, especially for someone with learning disabilities who struggles with languages. But then I thought back to what I had done before and said, well, screw it. If I can do that, I can do this. And I continue to apply it throughout my career and my life as a reminder that we are capable of so much more than we think ourselves to be. And you don't need a military experience to teach you that lesson, but it certainly helped me in my own personal journey. At a global level, having served in some precarious neighborhoods and been through a couple riots, had missiles fired over my head, just the idea of being on the receiving end of such a deep hatred that is completely agnostic to the person that they're shooting at, frankly. They have no idea who they're shooting at. It's a faceless monster to them that is responsible for all of their suffering. In this politically charged climate, sure, we hurl nasty comments at each other on Facebook and on Instagram, but there's a big jump between hurling a nasty comment and hurling a rocket. And it almost kind of shows you the extreme of where that sort of polarity can land you. And is almost a warning to me about how civil unrest begins with this pure hatred for the other that becomes faceless, that becomes this object to hate. And that feeling of being on the receiving end of hatred of that degree was one that stuck with me and one that was extremely painful and something that I've tried to kind of make sense of over the years. And certainly there is evil in this world. There are bad people who are teaching kids on that side that killing Israeli children is more important than protecting their own lives. And that is an absolute tragedy. But the casualties of that are not just Israeli. They are Palestinian teenagers who are brought up being taught to hate, that Israel is the great Satan that is responsible for all of the things that they struggle with in their lives. And so I didn't feel animosity necessarily for those people when I encountered them and at times had to arrest them, right? I saw scared children who were indoctrinated and found themselves in the back of an Israeli armored vehicle after having hopped the fence with a knife and felt bad for them, right? I mean, at the end of the day, right, I would do whatever was necessary to protect the Israeli settlement that they were running towards with a knife, but it's impossible not to zoom out with the benefit of some time and reflection and think about a society that can so successfully indoctrinate a kid who should be playing with a basketball to be running around with a knife instead. And that was something that really stuck with me and something that will need to go away if there's any hope for peace for future generations. And it's taught in mass on the Palestinian side, but to a smaller degree, it also exists within Israel among extremists who teach their kids that the Palestinians are all evil. And so I think on both sides, there's work to be done to prevent that hatred from permeating future generations.
Well, absolutely. And it's quite clear that, you know, there are innocent lives tied up in many of these international cross-border conflicts. And, you know, ideology does, unfortunately, transfer across generations without necessarily a lot of underpinning reason and understanding for it. And it, you know, becomes a sort of a distilled and purified version of itself, for better or worse. But I just wanted to take you back to a point you made there about the distance to travel between hurling vitriol and hurling rockets. And you must have having served and seeing that firsthand on a combat front, you must have watched with interest or trepidation certain parts of the Trump era where words were becoming extremely violent and used as a means to motivate people to action, such as the storming of the Capitol building.
Yeah, you know, there were those who supported him who said, you know, I look at his policy, not at his words. And to an extent, that's fine, except that words motivate actions, right? And have throughout history, right? That is the predecessor to any great action, is an orator stating his or her case and gathering people to share in the cause. So I don't think you can look at one without the other. And the results of that were very clear. I mean, it will be impossible to literally link, you know, any one of his speeches to any one of those actions. But if you're looking at the whole picture in aggregate, it's pretty clear that when you're having all these events that weren't happening before, and there's this guy in office who's saying all these things that kind of sync with what's happening, that there is some correlation between these two. And so, you know, for those of us who were concerned about that, it was pretty clear the link between those two things. And it was kind of remarkable to me that there are very intelligent people who see things differently than me, who kind of refuse to see the link between those two things.
Yeah, I mean, the absence of open-mindedness in people that you would have expected for that to be almost like a condition of office was pretty worrying. Anyway, you know, you're a liberal-minded sort of libertarian, in my view. You're an enlightened, balanced individual. I took from your book that that it could have really been taking place in any military service, you know, regardless of the tinderbox of it being in the Middle East there in the Holy Land. It really could have been translated to anyone's military service in any army in the world. You reflect in your epilogue of the book that for you, Israel, at that end of your tour, was somewhere between the idolized city on a hill, and it wasn't the sort of polar opposites that it's portrayed to be by many aspects of the sort of misinformed, uninformed media. And it's ultimately a microcosm of humanity. You make your book extremely devoid of any ideology, really. And actually, in the opening chapters of your book, you talk about your self propelled need to develop your capacity for empathy. And you followed the Seth Godin's alt-MBA kind of approach to viewing the other side, you know, putting yourself in the shoes of the other side. Can you tell us a bit more about what that has done for you in your capacity to see the full picture and not, you know, not subscribe to a particular polarized ideology?
Yeah, I think I'll quote Ryan Holiday, who says certainty doesn't age well, right? And I think throughout my life, whenever I have expressed complete certainty about a topic, inevitably I'm proven wrong down the line, right? I'm sure that you and I are here on planet Earth breathing, and beyond that, everything else is kind of imagined or extrapolated. And so I try to keep a true open mind about the things, especially the things that I feel most passionate about, because I've become aware that emotion can become a proxy for certainty, right? And the emotional feeling that I have towards a certain topic can at times blind me to my own biases. And so, of course, you know, I believe, I'm a Zionist. I believe that Israel has a right to exist and to protect itself. That's basically the definition of Zionism, by the way, which is often kind of misrepresented to be something that it's not. At its core, it's about the reestablishment and protection of the Jewish nation. It doesn't say anything about kicking out of other people or in any way holding them down. And so I think you can be a humanitarian and a Zionist, and those are not in conflict with each other. And that's something that I try to embody in my book. You mentioned kind of the absence of ideology. You know, to me, I'm not a historian. I'm not a master's in Middle Eastern studies. I'm a guy who, like every other guy in Israel and girl, goes through the military. I shouldn't say all. I think it's about 60% now. And who saw what I saw and did what I did. And to your point, I could have been an American soldier just as easily, joined for a love of his or her country, who saw things that were good and things that were bad and wanted to reflect on that experience. And so for me, it was important that I try to keep it to the area in which I was an expert, which is solely my own experiences, and let others draw the conclusions from that they will. You know, it was important to set the background. And so in some cases that required some historical context that inevitably strayed from my own personal narrative. But I felt in those places that it was important to do that, to give the reader context in cases where it might not be obvious why a military unit is operating in Hebron, which is a city that is populated by several hundred thousand Arabs, for instance. And so I tried to do my best to do that in an unbiased way. And I took great measures to fact check myself. I spoke to people on the right, Middle Eastern PhDs on the left, really trying to make sure that the facts that I was drawing from and the sources that I was drawing those facts from were valid sources and popularly accepted facts, even if the conclusions that I drew from them were not necessarily ones that the person I was speaking with agreed with.
Yeah, as I said, very balanced. And I'm really pleased to hear that the intentionality that went into that. So you know, here we both are in our generation, you know, the world that we've been dealt today. You know, I'm sitting here as a British male, 40-something, still trying to reconcile things like the Balfour Declaration in decisions made by my forefathers many generations ago. And you've touched on there about displacements of people and all that sort of stuff. You know, I honestly hope that with today's eyes in our heads and today's hearts in our chests, we could visualize a world where there is a bit more restoration of harmony in the Middle East and potentially some path to resolution. Do you think there can be peace?
I like to believe that there could be peace. I think we are several generations away at any given point. You know, some event leads a generation to stop teaching their children the hatred that they were taught. And at the point at which those kids' grandparents die and it's just those three generations that have been brought up with that new mentality, there's hope, right? But when you talk about hatred that's been built over 5, 6, 7, 8 decades, it's very hard to eradicate that hatred. And so I don't think it's something that can happen overnight. I think looking towards education is a big thing and a big way to impact the way the next generation looks at their neighbors. And so, you know, textbooks that Hamas hands out that feature, you know, the area of Israel devoid of the state of Israel, that's just labeled Palestine, certainly send the wrong message to children about where they're living and who their neighbors are. And so I would like to see more accountability on behalf of the international community for dollars spent in that region on educating people about the reality of the world in which they occupy, right? I would like them to be focused on not on the ideal of, you know, we're here and these other people don't belong here on either side. But I think going back to your original question, I can envision a world in which there's peace, but it's hard to imagine it, you know, within our lifetime. I do think that we can make great progress.
Yeah, I think the two-state solution is still a hope or a dream more than anything like a reality. Because to your point, you know, the path to peace is initially through dollars spent and work done to depolarize and to help see the alternative view and march towards a harmonious middle ground. But that's a very, very gradual process. I mean, closer to home for me, Northern Ireland is a sort of an example of where that can be achieved, albeit sometimes appearing to be a very delicate and tentative peace. But a peace, nonetheless, it is, which began with, you know, good education and development of empathy for each side. Yeah, but it was a willingness, you know, to end the troubles and to find an accommodation. I've yet to see that same willingness exhibited in the tinderbox that is the Levant.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing too, and I'll credit Jay Schultz with this idea, who's a friend of mine that lives in Israel. You know, if you think about the ideas that spread through society in today's day and age, a lot of them are taken on a phone that looks like this, right? People are able to amplify their voices. And because of the repressive nature of the PLO and Hamas, that's not really happening in the territories, right? And I bet you there are plenty of young people who would like to envision a future that's different from the world that they grew up in, who are simply, because of repression, not able to make those beliefs known. And so he asked the question, what if we funded an NGO and gave them $5 million to amplify those voices, to protect those folks with international peacekeepers, right? To allow their voices to be heard without fear of reprisals against them, against their families. What could we envision? Because I see this all the time as a microcosm within Israel proper, where those fears of reprisals don't really exist. I see groups of Israelis and Palestinians coming together in some cases where each have lost someone on within their immediate family to the conflict. And they're able to come together and have meaningful, deep conversations about what they want the future to look like. But we're not able to see that in these pockets of Israel, or what was once Israel, where there is no freedom of expression. And I think that's a big limiting factor because the average person, I believe, wants what's best for their family. They want to live in relative peace. And of course, you have extremists who stray from that narrative. But how do we empower those people to share their voice with the world and let it be known that the entire Gaza Strip does not share the ideology of Hamas, right? Not everyone there is pining for a one-state solution that has no Israel. There's a minority that holds onto power by all means necessary and projects the view that their ideology is the ideology of the people they govern, and it's not. And so, you know, free Gaza is a slogan that I say too. It's just we might be saying free Gaza from different people, right? I'm saying free Gaza from Hamas because I think that's the limiting factor that prevents the people living there from really expressing the way in which they'd like to be governed.
You would hope that in a semi-democratic society that an opposing force would emerge from within with a more balanced and enlightened outlook. Let's turn, if we can, to your writer's journey, because this is your first book. There's a labor of love gone into this and the product is really self-explanatory. But how did you find, what were the high points, what were the low points in the writing process for you?
For sure. So I had the benefit of a bit of an outline that I had written over time. When I joined the military, I started a blog, joiningtheidf.com, and blogged with some degree of consistency about my experiences, particularly the things that were most impactful that I was allowed to write about. And so when I finished, I looked at these kind of distinct puzzle pieces and was able to thread a story that would connect one to the other. And lo and behold, I had a cohesive book of sorts. And so the real challenge was in the editing of that into something that was palatable because frankly, a lot of the things repeated themselves. There was a lot of navigation training, right? There needed to be some themes that ran through the book that were not necessarily found in each individual blog post. And so a lot of the work was in cleanup, frankly, but also, my perspective changed over time, right? When you're 26 and newly out of the military, you see the world quite differently than you do when you're 32 with, 8 years of distance between you and that event. For me, it was, as you pointed out, a labor of love. It was about committing to consistent editing, you know, showing up at that cafe on Saturday when all my friends were out drinking and making those notes and writing and editing. And it took so much longer than I thought it would, frankly. I mean, the number of hours I put into this, I can't even articulate. It was all consuming when I was within it. But ultimately, the result is something that I'm very proud of, and I wouldn't have done it differently.
Well, that's really interesting. Your 3 years spent in Israel was one part of a lifetime of traveling. And you mentioned the time you spent in Brazil. And I've always seen you as somebody that enjoys traveling and travels to some extremely interesting places. Would you speak to whether that has been a formative part of your journey in terms of, you know, the wisdom that you've gained, the enlightenment that you've gained by seeing other cultures sort of and immersing yourself in them?
Certainly. I think one of the things that traveling to other places does is allows you to appreciate what you have. And, you know, for all of the shortcomings we have here in the United States, I'm extremely proud of this country and where we are today, how far we've come from where we started. I've been to places in South America that are quite poverty-ridden, particularly in Brazil. You just realize that the opportunity that exists in this country is just non-existent in so many other places in the world. And so you gain an appreciation for everything that you have, even if it's not perfect. And I think traveling, you know, kind of what we discussed in the beginning, that first-person experience of seeing what else is out there enlightens you to the beauty of the things that you have when you go back home. And of course, it's not just about looking upon other cultures and saying, wow, you have it really shitty. It's also about the beauty of those cultures. You know, Brazil is a really fun-loving country where people are warm and inviting. And, you know, on a Sunday, you can sit in a cafe and watch live samba. And it's not weird to talk to the person next to you and say hi and say, oh, it's a great band. It's a very communal culture. And I think, you know, we could use a little bit more of that here in America, right? There are places here where when you speak to the person next to you on the subway, they believe you're crazy. So I think there's also things that we can take from these other places that we're missing in our home countries. So it's a bit of both. There's the appreciation for what you have when you notice it absent in that other country. And then there's the noticing what you don't have that might be nice to incorporate into your life back wherever it is you live.
Never a truer word. So one of those things that you have in America and we have in the UK, albeit in slightly different permutations, is a properly functioning healthcare system to preserve and extend the lives of its citizens. And you've devoted a considerable amount of your career to working in health tech. What for you is the great attraction of that sector? And what do you see on the near-term horizon as being one of the greatest innovations that will transform healthcare?
When I got my master's in healthcare innovation, it opened my eyes to three big areas where I think an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so, you know, I look at there was kind of three areas that were illuminated for me where I said, we are doing such a poor job here on the preventative side of things that it's costing us billions of dollars in downstream costs. So those three areas for me were behavioral health. I believe someone with a comorbid diagnosis of psychosis or a behavioral health condition costs 6 to 7 times what their counterpart with the same underlying conditions costs. Because as you can imagine, if you're depressed, it's not easy for you to take your medication or to do the exercise that you know you need to do, right? It's kind of self-evident, but there are huge costs associated with not helping people get the behavioral health that they need. And our healthcare system today does not treat the whole person. We treat individual parts of the person and act as though they are disparate. We treat their physical health on one hand, their behavioral health on the other. And there's an increased awareness of the need to refocus our efforts, right? COVID has really shed light on that. 1 in 3 Americans now struggle with anxiety, depression, or both. SAMHSA perceives a shortage of 4.5 million behavioral health clinicians required to address the need in this country. And so there are some fantastic innovative companies that are working to help to shift our system in the direction that I think will be best. One of them I could call out is Quartet, which basically sits at the primary care level, identifies patients who could use behavioral health services and plays quarterback digitally and makes sure that someone reaches out to that patient within a set period of time. I think it's 48 hours. And so they've reduced no-shows by, I think, 30 or 40%. And, you know, the Affordable Care Act passed by Obama really put this into motion. But the idea of moving from a world where clinicians are compensated under a fee-for-service model, and what that basically means is you perform a service and you get paid a fee. So if Corey ends up in the hospital, if he's there for 5 days or he's there for 10 days, the hospital is going to get paid $2,000 a night no matter what, versus something called value-based care, which aims to reimburse the provider based on the value that they are providing. So one form of value-based care is something called bundle payments. For instance, Bill needs a hip replacement. Bill lives in a certain zip code. And the insurance company says, for someone in this zip code, a hip replacement should cost $20,000 all in. So here you go, hospital. Here's 20 grand. Spend this as you deem fit on the inpatient care, the outpatient care, the durable medical equipment. And if you do it for 15, you can keep some of that $5,000. It's called a shared savings model, right? And there's even better ones now where people are taking on the risk. So primary care docs are getting paid X thousand dollars a month, and they are responsible for the total cost of care of their patients. And so their incentive is to make sure that that patient stays healthy and out of the emergency room. And so for me, if you follow the money in healthcare, you quickly understand why things work or don't. And when I think about the best way to get to a system where everyone is working for the benefit of the patient to improve health outcomes and lower costs, moving towards that value-based care model to me holds great promise in eliminating many of the inefficiencies that today are the cause of so many of the problems here.
You speak there about the holistic approach, and I'm interested to see how that plays into the bundle payments and the combined value-based charging model. I think we've forgotten a lot as we've evolved as humanity. And if you look back at sort of older Eastern methodologies of both faith, but also the practices around preserving health, that body, mind and soul piece working in harmony and treating the entire patient because of the consequences of a mind on the body and vice versa. I think we've gone backwards from that step and only now are rediscovering the interrelationship between all of those faculties. Is there much work actually actively going on at the moment to treat the mind and the body at the same time and stop that self-reinforcing process?
At a systematic level, right? You could think about kind of on the one hand, pure providers, which are either behavioral health clinics or doctor's offices. Then you have hospitals. Then you have what's called integrated delivery networks, which are both hospitals and payers kind of rolled up together. And then, of course, payers and private industry. And within each of those subsets, I believe there is gradual or differing degrees of movement towards a more holistic approach. Certainly in the private sector, if you look up behavioral health startups, you'll find hundreds, right, of companies that are doing their best to figure out how they can use technology to help clinicians treat the whole patient, whether that's flagging something in the EHR that looks suspicious for that primary care doctor. EHR is electronic health record. Some will call it an EMR, an electronic medical record. And that's basically just the electronic equivalent of the file of the patient's chart that used to exist to say, hey, you know, Mrs. Jones, I think you might be able to benefit from speaking to my colleague, Lisa, who's down the hall. Would you mind if I set you up for an appointment in 20 minutes? Because the system identified that her PHQ-9 came back, you know, positive for depression, right? So that's kind of one microcosm of it. But when I speak to health system leaders, I see major progress towards the understanding of the associated costs, both at a moral and financial level of not treating the whole patient. And so I'm seeing greater collaboration within health systems to do a better job of addressing both at once. There are innovative folks, one of whom I'll call out, Carol Vargas at Atlantic Health System, who are thinking critically about how to treat the whole patient and how to keep the people that come in the doors of her hospital from coming in there again, whether or not she's financially incentivized to do so today, because she and all great leaders know that down the line we have value-based care coming, and that will incentivize people to do what's best for their patients, even if it's coming at a much, much slower rate than any of us hoped it would.
Before we go, we like to tend to ask our guests to give us a window into their values or their vision of the future world. And I'd appreciate it if you'd leave our listeners with an insight of what virtues or principles most drive you in life and most motivate you in the work that you do to shape the world of the future.
I think for me, and we've touched on this a bit, humility is something that is very important to me. I think intellectual curiosity and humility go together. The desire to always learn more and uncover ways in which your present way of thinking may be wrong or incomplete, I think has led me to some of my most interesting conversations, travels, and learnings in general. So I think that's a value that drives me. Contribution, the need to feel that what I'm doing each day matters and is making the world better rather than worse. And certainly working in the healthcare space has really helped me to embody that. I think it was not as easy to find in other industries, but in healthcare, when done properly, there is hope that these innovations that I'm trying to bring to market will genuinely make life better for the people who they impact. And I think the third would be servant leadership, being able to build teams of people that are motivated because they share that vision, not the Glengarry Glen Ross of the 80s who said, this is my way, sell or get out, but you know, what's going on in your life? How can I remove roadblocks for you? How can I help you? It's so obvious when a leader embodies that mentality, and it's so obvious when they don't. And it's so much more pleasant and inspiring to work for someone who thinks and leads that way, that it has become my mission to become that person for people that I will hire down the line. And so I really try to think about how I can incorporate that into my general way of being, because who you are some of the time is who you are all of the time. So that's kind of been something that I've been working on quite a bit recently.
And that right there is where we overlap so well and why we're good friends, because, you know, that humility and servant leadership is something that I've tried to embody also. And it's very clear in the way you go about your life and the people that you touch and how you listen to other people's lives, experiences, and opinions, which is exemplary. So, yeah, it's very much a common theme on this podcast. I would encourage anyone contemplating leadership for the future to adopt those principles and precepts, because that is certainly the shape of leadership to come. So, Corey, any closing thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with regard to particularly your book, how they can go about getting a copy, how they can reach you for speaking gigs and general opining?
Yeah, certainly. So the book is sold on Amazon, both in the UK Amazon and the US Amazon, depending on where listeners are located. I can be reached at theexaminedlifenyc@gmail.com, which is also the name of my blog. And I'm sure you can put that in the show notes. for anyone that forgets. But
certainly will.
Yes, always interested in intellectual conversations, particularly people that disagree with me. I always enjoy hearing about things that I'm unaware of or blind spots that I may have. And just in general, I really appreciate you having me on the show. And it's been great, as always, chatting with you. I always learn from you as well.
Well, it's been my absolute pleasure. You also have a podcast of your own. Would you like to just give us the title of that so listeners can find it on various platforms?
For sure. So there's two. One is the Lone Soldier podcast, in which I interview former lone soldiers who served in the Israeli Defense Forces. And the second is Healthcare Reimagined, where I interview healthcare leaders from the private sector as well as government organizations about how they are shaping the future of healthcare in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. And both of those are on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Fantastic. Recommended listening. Go check it out. And I'll make sure there are some links in the show notes, as always. So, Corey, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for giving up 45 minutes of your day today from what was an early morning in New York State. And look forward to speaking with you again very soon. And for now, wish you well.
Thanks so much, Gareth.
Corey's journey is not a conventional one, and his perspicacity and self-awareness is admirable. I always enjoy speaking with him as he challenges me to look at things from different perspectives, something that should always be encouraged in order to reach an informed and balanced viewpoint. If you enjoyed this episode or would like to join me as a future guest, please let us know, either via LinkedIn, on Twitter at GPGHawkins, or via email to podcast@ceoptimist.com. And please do like, subscribe, and turn on notifications for this podcast to automatically receive our future updates. In our next pod, I'll be speaking with Bim Afolami, Conservative Member of the UK Parliament, now in his second term in government, and currently the chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Renewable and Sustainable Energy Group. We'll be discussing the pursuit of clean energy and the journey to net carbon zero, ahead of the forthcoming COP26 UN Climate Change Conference taking place in Glasgow this November. Do tune in, it promises to be highly informative. Until then, remember to live with intention, make choices based on your values, and not let the choices of other people define you.